In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Anne has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business, committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool, with additional locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with jQuery and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
And Beyond the Bricks comes to you from inside the Race Command Center, the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley. jQuery along with Mike Thompson. Landon Coons putting it all together for us. We call this program Beyond the Bricks, a look back at the history, the personalities, the backstories of the greatest spectacle in racing. Sometimes we talk about those that have owned the track. Sometimes we talk about those that have promoted the track. Sometimes we talk about those that have conquered the track. And that is the case with our episode tonight. The story of a Canadian who, in just his second Indianapolis 500-mile race, catapulted himself into the upper stratosphere of immortality in becoming an Indy 500 champion. And Mike Thompson, this is for you, I know. The month of May is the month of Christmas for all of us. But for you, this particular year, in 2025, taking a look back on the anniversaries, we've done that with Danny Sullivan, Spin to Win, the 40th anniversary. And tonight, we do something special for you. Now, before we get to that, let me ask you this question, of which most people know the answer off the immediate top of their head from a personal standpoint as it relates to themselves. So I will ask you in hopes that you will know the answer right off the top of your head. I've been to how many Indianapolis 500-mile races?
Oh, I think 16, I believe.
Okay, if you can believe this, this year, and you're going to disown me with what I'm about to tell you, this year will be my 40th Indianapolis 500. Of course, I grew up in Indianapolis, so I have a huge advantage and blessing in that regard. One of the very few that I have missed was the race that took place on May 28th of 1995, the 79th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. But I might have missed it when it happened, but we're going to recreate it tonight, Mike.
Very good. And you know, this is one of my personal favorites. This is tied for my favorites since I've been born. Of all the 500 since I've been born, this is tied for my favorite. So this is a special one for me. I am an unabashed, as anyone who knows me will tell you, I am an unabashed Jack Villeneuve fan. Monumental, massive Jack Villeneuve fan.
So, now, let me ask you this before we get into bringing back to life, if you will, the 1995 Indianapolis 500-mile race, Mike. Is there a specific reason for your affinity? And obviously, it goes without saying, I don't disagree with you at all about Jacques Villeneuve. I mean, I think he is one of the most naturally gifted duck-to-water drivers ever to drive at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The results speak to that in their own right. But was he one that you were a fan in the moment, or retroactively you have grown an appreciation for and thus look back fondly on that particular race?
Oh, no, I was a fan in the moment. In fact, if my dad is listening, he will tell you that when we were watching this particular race in Toledo, I was jumping around the room like a madman when Jack was going to win the race. So, no, I was a fan of Jack from the start. And I was a fan of his dad's, obviously, in Formula One. And with a potential Canadian winner in a couple different ways, I was excited about it, but I was really excited for Jack. So when Jack Villeneuve won the race, my dad will tell you I did dancing that probably he probably doesn't want to see again, because it was, you know, just not very good dancing.
The 1995 Indianapolis 500, when it comes to dancing and not dancing very well, was an interesting one, because you had a team, one of the most famous in the history of the event, that, and certainly the most successful, that had always danced like Fred Astaire. And there was really no question when Roger Penske would bring his group to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway that it was going to be absolutely a ballet of perfect symmetry, perfect timing, perfect speeds in order to try to qualify for win the Indianapolis 500-mile race. And it just so happened that they had not one, but two, but four left feet, not left turns, but left feet when it came to qualifying for 1995. After dominating the 1994 race, Mike, in one of the most incredible machines ever to conquer Indianapolis, in the Beast, the Mercedes that Penske had had basically under wraps in 1994 and then came out and dominated so much that race with Emerson Fittipaldi and Alan Sir Jr. winning the race, with M.O. seemingly finishing second before his late crash would knock him out. But from 1994 to 1995, oh, how things, Mike, changed from one year to the next in terms of perhaps being overly spoiled with that Mercedes power and then having to come back in 1995. And I don't think it was until the final gun sounded of qualifying that people could truly grasp that Roger Penske's team was suddenly scrambling for and trying to find any combination for speed.
Yeah, that's the case. And I mean, what's interesting is I think a lot of people would tell you that maybe the Beast engine kind of masked some of the problems with the Penske's, with chassis at the time, that they weren't really having the, they didn't have the chassis dialed in the way they needed to, but it was kind of, you didn't need to because the Beast was so good. Anyone who watched that 1994 race, if you told them, okay, next year Penske's not going to make the race entirely, no one would have believed that. I mean, that no one would have bought that story. And it just was one of the most incredible things. And it was one of those situations where no matter what combination they tried, it didn't work. They tried to, some cars from the Ray Hall operation. And actually, at one point, if they would have took one of Emerson's speeds, he would have made the race, but they waved it off. It's just nothing was working right. I mean, the decisions they were making weren't Penske-like decisions, and it was just an utter disaster.
And of course, they didn't know it at the time, but once you had the split in open-wheel racing between the Indy Racing League and CART, Roger Penske, Alan Sir Jr., it would be years before they would return to the Indianapolis 500 for a chance to qualify. But whoever would have guessed it, Alan Sir Jr., Roger Penske, would not qualify and would miss the show in 1995.
The last lap will tell the tale, and it will have to be hot.
And that first lap of 221 may tell the story, because I don't see enough speed here through our speed traps to lift Al Unser into the 227s or 8 range, which is what it will take to bring that average above Emerson's. Al Jr. is in deep trouble.
Heading for the checkered flag, keeping an eye now on the final lap. He has to beat 224.9. 224.907, he can't do it. He doesn't do it. Al Unser Jr. has not yet qualified. Fittipaldi is still in the field. Now what will this man, Roger Penske, do? The team has never been in this situation. And 225.547 takes Emerson Fittipaldi, the second and final Penske car, out of the field. Tony Bettenhausen has a car in the field. And look at the joy and a celebration for the Alumax team down there.
One of the great things about this program and taking a look back at things like, for example, the great storyline of the 1995 qualifying struggles for Team Penske is it does allow us to hear from and remember those that were great friends, not just to the Speedway, but to Mike and I as well. And, of course, Robin Miller was one that was... And Mike, actually, we'll just go ahead and opine this real quick as well. I know that Robin Miller was a polarizing figure, and he's not the subject necessarily of tonight's program, but he was a guy that, in my experience, and I'm going to assume yours was the same, if you knew Robin Miller from day one, you would have thought that you had known him for 100 years, and anybody around would have. We heard the other night somebody talking about Tony Holman saying that one of the things that made him so special was he made everyone feel like they were the most important person to him in that moment. Robin Miller, I always felt, and I'm saying this just because we're about to hear from him, aside from the different things that he's going to talk about, anytime that Robin Miller's name comes up, I always feel compelled to let people know that he was a tremendous friend to racing, but he was a friend to those that he knew. And even though I realized that he was a polarizing figure, publicly speaking, privately, he was as generous and loyal as anybody you'll meet.
Oh, I definitely agree with that. He treated me very well. I didn't know him that well. I didn't know him at all before I moved to Indianapolis. And then when I moved there and started working at WIBC, I called him for some different projects, and he always helped me. And he always was really nice when he'd come to meet me at the memorabilia show. He'd stand at my table and just talk and really made me feel like I had been a friend for a long time. So I agree 100%.
Robin Miller on the Penske struggles of 1995.
I think the cruelest day of I ever watched was 95 bump day when Roger Penske missed the show. Eddie Cheever and I are sitting on a pit wall at 4:15. He keeps looking at his watch and he goes, "It's 4:15. There's an hour." He goes, "Roger Penske didn't have a car in the race yet." It was, and that was the last. I mean, that was a. It wasn't a pole day crowd, but that was the last big crowd they had prior to the split. It was bump day, and it was. Watching the Penske guys run back and forth to the garage and springs and shocks and change. And I mean, it was, they'd never been in that situation before. They never had. And I was working at Channel 13 then, and Roger Penske was our analyst, and Dave Calabro says, "Go get him." So I went in the garage and I said, "RP," I said, "come out." And he came out and faced the music. And I always take my hat off to the guy. He didn't buy his way in the field. He said, "You know what? We weren't fast enough to make it. We'll watch on race day and we'll be back next year." Pretty classy. When Ray Hall gave them their cars, they just said, "Just go run them." Well, the first thing they did, I think, took them to the bear rack, and they put the Penske set up on them and slowed them down 8 miles an hour. Yeah. Plus, Emerson had the race made, and RP yellow flagged him on Saturday.
That's right.
So there was a lot of circumstances, but they were never in that situation before. They never were ever in a last-second panic, whereas our guys like Tom Bigelow and Ellen Rasmussen, Jerry Sneva, George Snyder, hell, that was Rich Vogler. That was standard operating procedure. 10-6, no hot laps. Sure, I'll drive.
Yeah.
Once the race would begin in 1995, sure, there was no Team Penske. There was no Allanser Jr., who was the defending winner. It doesn't mean that it was not a race with tremendous excitement, tremendous expectation, and just a lot of curiosity as to what exactly it could be that would happen and that could unfold, as I always say, when it comes to the race. Scott Brayton was your pole sitter. The race got underway, and it didn't take long, unfortunately, for a terrible crash to take place. And it involved several cars, but none of them, certainly more visibly speaking, is an image that stands out any more than Stan Fox at the start of the 1995 Indianapolis 500.
We're ready for the start of the 79th running of the Indianapolis 500. Here's Bob Jenkins.
Here they come. The green flag is out, and the 79th Indianapolis 500 is underway.
The Menard team side by side already into the short shoot.
Fire breaks out. Ken, I believe they're in front of you over there.
We have got two cars who have been involved in a major crash. We've got about a third of the field all the way down onto pit lane. There are two more cars trailing the first crash, and from our vantage point, it is difficult to see. We're now trying to identify the cars, but indeed, a major crash coming out of one along the short chute and into two. We have lost four cars, it appears. Stan Fox, perhaps, is one of them. We're going to double check as far as the identification of the other cars. Again, it is just coming into turn two where the cars have come to a halt and unfortunately unable to get through the first lap of this race. And again, an unfortunate occurrence right in front of Jerry Baker. And now we have emergency equipment all over the racetrack.
Mike, I know that, you know, you've been to 21 Indianapolis 500-mile races. I don't know in those times of the races you've been, certainly that there was a more image that was more, and obviously Stan Fox would survive the crash, but that just had an imagery that was more kind of terrifying in the moment than that crash of that car. And, of course, the cars are made for the energy to disperse and to have everything go away from the driver. But to see Stan Fox with the tub torn apart and to visibly see him strapped into the cockpit there in turn number one was certainly an image. There have been a lot, I realize, but it was something that I think virtually anybody that was there or watched remembers about the 1995 Indy 500.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the things I remember was I knew Stan before the accident, and Stan was a real happy-go-lucky guy. I mean, always a smile on his face, always a joke when joking around with you, and quick with a joke, quick-witted. Really fun guy to be around. And I'll be candid with you. After Stan's accident, unfortunately, Stan was a different guy. You know, he didn't have that same, you know, friendly demeanor. I mean, he wasn't, you know, mean or rude or anything, but he just did not have that same demeanor. And it's so sad that injury, you know, caused him so many problems in life, because if you knew Stan before the accident, I mean, he was just such a joy to be around, and just, you know, always so much fun to be around all the time. And then after the accident, such a devastating crash. I mean, unfortunately, he just was a different person, sadly. That after crashes, I mean, a lot of us are different. I mean, I broke my neck on I-70, and I'm a different guy. So I understand it, but just really a sad situation.
Stan Fox would start in 8 Indianapolis 500s. That 1995 race would be his final race. Interestingly enough, he had two top tens, the first of which was in his rookie year in 1987, when he would finish a career best 7th. But Stan Fox would pass away in the year 2000 in a civilian car crash in the country of New Zealand. But certainly one of the great personalities to have come to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Shortly after that crash, R.A. Leyendijk, Scott Sharp got into it just a little bit, because Leyendijk felt like Sharp might have been blocking him a little bit, gave him, Mike, you describe it as a splendid gesture, correct?
That's correct. There's a Monty Python album, and they say that he gave him a splendid gesture, and I always use that whenever I'm giving somebody that particular gesture, which I try not to do that often on the road, but occasionally I have to do that.
And this would lead to the headrest, if I'm not mistaken. Didn't R.A. Leyendijk have some car complications from all of this?
That's correct. He actually gave him, Parnelli Jones calls this the number one sign. So he gave him the number one sign. And when he gave him the number one sign, the headrest got knocked out of Ari's car, and that caused a caution flag. But that caution flag caused all kinds of chaos and problems, and actually caused problems for Jack Villeneuve.
Keep in mind, when you were a kid in school, you would hear about things that were known as foreshadowing, talking about the pace car 1995 and having problems picking up the leader. Jacques Villeneuve was indeed the leader, but this would create a situation, a fiasco, if you will, at the start of that 79th race.
Bob, the lead cars were still at speed, and evidently, I don't know whether Jacques Villeneuve realized that he was in the lead or not, but the pace car, there was a block of cars came along, and they were waving the slower cars by, and then Villeneuve, and it would be, let's see, Michael Andretti, anyway, several cars went by, and I think because these cars can't run as slow as the pace car is running, I think they're going to have to let everybody go around again before they can pick up Villeneuve.
So the pace car has not picked up the leader, Johnny.
No, and I've seen this situation happen before, being the pace car driver at all the other races for PPG Industries. And Villeneuve is still, they're still looking for him. So here he comes by us now. And he's headed for the pace car.
There would not have been a problem if there were lapped cars directly in front of Villeneuve. I just don't think the pace car could get the attention of Villeneuve and be able to duck in quick enough. But now they've slowed way down, and this time I think it'll work out okay.
And still, the pace car has not yet. Now, just now, in turn number 3, the pace car finally picks up the leader of the race, Jacques Villeneuve. Boy, a lot of confusion here, it seems like, in these yellow laps.
I'm concerned about the fact that Villeneuve and a couple behind him haven't made a stop yet. And because it's taken so long for them to pack up, Bob, we're at 41 laps. I didn't think you could stretch it that far.
And here comes Villeneuve into the pits. He has turned left and is headed now toward the pit area.
And of course, whenever something like this would happen on the racetrack, then the timing and scoring would come down and say, you know what, we have a penalty here. And in the moment, that meant it was the end of the day for the second year driver out of Canada.
A major story is developing here, because the report is that Jacques Villeneuve will be penalized for passing the pace car. So that fiasco, Johnny, that we saw there during the caution is going to be a very tough blow for Jacques Villeneuve.
It really is, and it's a shame, because it's a situation where he should have been paying a little better attention and watching the pace car. I don't know what he was thinking about. Maybe waiting for the pit to open up so he could come in and make that pit stop.
Mike, it's interesting because when you break down races and you look at it, like, let's say in quarters, if you will, through the first quarter of that race in 1995, really, I mean, realistically, probably the first 15% of it, but through the first quarter of the race, there was so much that took place, so many obstacles and variables that were suddenly and monkey wrenches thrown into things, that you would have thought that it would have been smooth sailing from there. But what we're about to find out, Mike, is that a lot of what we've already seen became a pattern, if you will, and something that would be talked about for another 30 years about that 79th running.
Yeah, the pace car became definitely a story the whole day, and it's really a story, obviously, at the end of the race. But, you know, when you get a penalty, like a two-lap penalty like Jack Villeneuve did, you know, that should be the end of your race. And he battled back, obviously, from that. So really, really interesting how all this works out.
It was perhaps not his runner-up finish in his rookie year that really was the storyline in the first two-year career of Jacques Villeneuve. Obviously, that alone would speak to his greatness, and so too would winning the race. But it was the way in which he won it and the things that he overcame that I think most display and illuminate the greatness of the guy that was piloting that machine, car number 27, on that day 30 years ago. And we'll let you hear what we're talking about when we return to Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Ane has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business, committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool, with additional locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box. Store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there. But you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
The 1995 Indianapolis 500, we're taking a look back on that tonight. Mike, when we left everybody there, we were in a situation where Jacques Villeneuve found himself behind the eight ball, so to speak. A lot of work to do to try to get back up towards the front for the young driver.
Yeah, I mean, again, that should have been the end of the day when you get a two-lap penalty. Now, the thing that was benefit to him was that it was very early in the race, gives him an opportunity to come back. But that's still a tough day when you're already two laps behind at the beginning like that.
And Michael Andretti is the driver that would eventually take over the race in terms of the lead and the pace itself. But as is always the case, or seemingly was, with Michael Andretti, once again, bad fortune at the Brickyard would bite him again.
Sally?
Enemy pointing to the front of his car. They're working around the wheel area now. It looks like they're kind of at a loss as to what to do. Lee White, the team manager, is pointing over the wall. Tim Bunks, his crew chief, just kind of throws up his hands.
They don't know what to do. I think they're at a loss as to really what happened, but it looks like Michael Andretti's day is over.
Unbelievable. Michael Andretti, who was setting the pace here, is apparently out of the action. Do you know what might have happened up there in turn four, Bob Lamy?
Well, coming through four, he came out very high, Bob, and whether he made contact with the wall just in front of us, I don't know. It's very difficult to see, but he made a sharp left across the racetrack and into the pits from that area. Everything under control as he did it, but it was all of a sudden it seemed he made a move. Whether he saw something, felt something, he's in the pits now.
So the bad luck of the Andretti crew continues at Indianapolis.
By lap 140, Jimmy Vassar would take his turn at the front of the field and all of a sudden become one of the names that many thought perhaps it would be his day. Mike, they always say that the Indianapolis Motor Speedway picks her winners. Now, that's not to say that she had anything against Michael Andretti or Jimmy Vassar. But on this particular day, clearly she didn't feel it was their time, and Lady Luck would not be really on the side of either one of them.
No, Lady Luck was definitely not on the side of either one of them in that case. I mean, Michael just got a little bit high and really didn't even hit the wall that hard, but it just put him out of the race. And then another situation came up where Jimmy Vassar just gets in the marbles. And when he gets in the marbles, you know, there's just no saving it at that point, and that put Jimmy Vassar out.
So Jimmy Vassar drops out of the race. This happened on lap 170.
Single file down the back straightaway to Larry Henry in turn three.
Scott Pruitt touch and goes to the low side of Jimmy Vassar. He's got the lead. Scott Pruitt, Vassar has to back out. He's way high. He touches the wall. He hits the wall in three. Vassar had nowhere to go as Scott Pruitt went down low. We've got the yellow out, but Scott Pruitt has the lead.
Jimmy Vassar has crashed. The car has stopped in turn number four in front of Bob Lamy.
Well, way along the wall, we just, as Larry Henry mentioned it, we could see Vassar touch the wall of the short chute. He slid along the short chute. We got one of the safety vehicles right there against the wall is Jimmy Vassar. Safety crew to him. Larry, what have you got?
Well, as we watched him come in, Scott Pruitt dove to the bottom side. Jimmy Vassar nowhere to go. You cannot go through this turn full throttle. He backed out. He tried to hold it. He was a whole car length above the racing group, tried to ride it. He just ran out of room and brushed the wall, rode it across the north short chute coming to a stop in four. He just had nowhere to go, backed out, tried to save it. He just ran out of racetrack.
At that time, Mike, this was 10 years removed roughly from the movie Back to the Future, and the crowd was probably thinking to themselves, great Scott, we've got a race here, because it was actually a battle between two Scotts. Scott Goodyear, a Canadian, and Scott Pruitt. Really did look on a day that was really, really slippery. Bobby Unser, I remember saying that the track was just, the conditions weren't great. It was windy, it was slippery, and it felt like perhaps that would become a factor, but it really did feel like Pruitt and Goodyear were the two that were fighting it out for the win.
And I think people forget how windy it really was at the end of the race. It was quite windy. Now, there were other contenders. I mean, Mauricio Guzman was really good in that race. People might forget Mauricio Guzman led the most laps in the 500 in 1995. So he was a real contender at one point as well. So, the wind in the second half of the race really picked up, and especially in the last 30 laps. I mean, if you watch the telecast, Bobby Unser mentions the wind multiple times of how windy it was, especially coming out of turn two.
Scott Pruitt, as we talked about, was up there in contention inside of 16 laps from the finish when the wind, perhaps a factor, Scott Pruitt was out.
On a breezy afternoon in Indianapolis, Indiana, 184 laps completed, and Scott Pruitt is spinning off of turn two.
Scott Pruitt got high in turn two and kissed the wall and hit the outside wall, slid backwards, hit the inside retaining wall across the grass, and one of the leaders is out. In a disheartening turn of event here late in the race, Scott Pruitt hit the wall and he is out. We are under yellow again. An unbelievable turn of events here with nearing just 15 laps to go. Bob Jenkins.
1995 will be remembered for many things. We have just seen an incredible turn of events in the practice and the qualifying and now in the race.
What an incredible roller coaster this has been. And poor Scott Pruitt sitting there racing. The thoughts must be racing through his mind at this point.
Those windy conditions might actually have been whipping around several maple leaf flags, I should say, because Canadians started to show at that point, one would assume, their pride if they were in the crowd for the 1995 Indianapolis 500, because you had Scott Goodyear, you had Jacques Villeneuve, who had worked his way back. Let's get to that, Mike, and the fact that here you have two drivers from Canada. None had ever won the race from our neighbors to the north, but it came down essentially to those two drivers, and it is really remarkable, even 30 years later, to think about the fact that at this point in the race now, we were discussing or are discussing the fact that Villeneuve had put himself back in position to be in contention, considering what had happened to him earlier in the race.
Oh, yeah, there's no question about it. Again, he had a lot of luck, basically, helped out. He got yellows at the right time, and, you know, it just worked out exactly right for Villeneuve to get back in the race. There was a yellow that Andre Ribeiro stalled on the track, and Jack got a lap back, and then he got another break when his fellow countryman Paul Tracy had a yellow, brought out a yellow with electrical problems in his car. So just the fact that Villeneuve was even going to get a potential top five out of it was shocking. And then all of a sudden he's in a chance to win the race, and there's two Canadians at the front of the field.
So by the time they'd gotten everything cleaned up, by the time they were ready to go again after the Scott Pruitt crash, they were ready to go back to green. And when they went back to green, you had in that moment Scott Goodyear in the lead, Jacques Villeneuve running second, the pace car in front of both of them. And inside now of what would be essentially the last 10 laps of the race, one of the biggest controversies in the history of the Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Well, the pace car is still on the racetrack. Let's see. It moves through corner number four. And Goodyear went around the pace car. He went around the pace car. The green flag is coming out. The pace car is now off the racetrack. We are under green at Indianapolis. We'll see what happens.
They didn't know, even though it was expected, Mike, whether or not Goodyear was going to be penalized ultimately for that infraction. It didn't take long, though, for the ruling to come out and to find out that Scott Goodyear was going to undergo the same sort of penalty that Jacques Villeneuve had had earlier in the race.
Yeah, we weren't 100% sure. We thought that was the case, but they didn't immediately give him a penalty, obviously, because they had to talk it over, look it over, and make sure everything, you know, that they... that he did break the rule, which it looked like obviously he did on the video. And so once they finally in race control, they confirmed the fact that there was an infraction. He was given the penalty, a really tough situation to have to go through. But, you know, Paul Page and, you know, Paul Page really in this clip, it's interesting because you don't want the 500 to end because of a penalty or, you know, a thing like what happened in 1981. You don't want it. You want it to be a duel on the racetrack like we saw in 82 or 92, things like that. And Paul in this clip is, you know, you could tell he's just a little crestfallen just because he doesn't want the 500 to be decided on a penalty.
But that's exactly, for all intent and purposes, what decided it to some great extent. Although, who knows? We don't know what could have happened in a shootout. But it was Paul Page who confirmed on ABC television, in fact, that Goodyear was being penalized.
Oh, no. The officials are now reporting they're going to show the black flag to Scott Goodyear, the 24 car. You're on board with him now. They're going to show the black flag to the leader of the race. Stop and go penalty because he passed the pace car before the green. Scott Goodyear is about to lose the Indy 500 on a penalty. A black flag stop and go.
One thing before we get to hearing how this race would end, Mike, that I have always felt. I understand why Scott Goodyear, once the black flag came out, stayed out, because I would be thinking to myself, and you tell me if you agree here, Mike, if you come in to serve your penalty, your day is automatically done. If you stay out and you go ahead and complete the race and then do an appeal, even though your odds may be infantile of winning said appeal, you at least have tangible evidence that you had completed all of your laps and that you were scored basically then where the appeal, if it came down to that, where they would have to go back and look at it. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
100%. In fact, later on, we'll hear from Scott in the next segment, and he basically says the same thing. He says there's, you know, the reason he didn't come in for the black flag is when Steve Horn told him, hey, you've got a penalty, you've been black flag, you got to come in. And he basically says, no, I'm not doing that, because if I come in, there's no chance of winning.
Correct.
There was really very little chance of winning at that point anyway, but there was zero chance if he came in for the stop and go.
He inevitably, of course, saw the black flag, even though he didn't come in for it. Jacques Villeneuve would ultimately see a flag with black in it, but white squares as well. The checkered flag in the 1995 Indy 500.
Jacques Villeneuve, his second Indianapolis 500, second last year. It looks like first this year. He has a lap and a half to go to win the greatest race in the world.
Again, Jacques Villeneuve moving through turn four. He is just very smooth, maybe even slowing just a little bit to make certainly smooth. He heads to the main straightaway, one lap to go.
The white flag is waved, one to go for Jacques Villeneuve. He's on his final lap, Jerry.
About 4 seconds is the lead time that he has. Can it hang together for another couple of miles? Oh, this is going to be a great finish for Jacques Villeneuve into the number two turn.
And Villeneuve smoothly through two, well off the wall, keeping a fine line down the back straightaway, Larry Henry. Jacques Villeneuve bringing it down the back straightaway. No traffic in front of him. Cleanly down to the white line. The crowd on their feet cheering Jacques Villeneuve. One more turn to go. Jacques
in the field at 24 years of age, has won at Indianapolis.
So Jacques Villeneuve in just his second Indianapolis 500, what would ultimately be the second of three, but not until, of course, a long run within Formula One before coming back, running one more time at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, was a winner in Indianapolis. As for Scott Goodyear, he, of course, is no stranger towards fantastic and controversial, dramatic finishes at the Indianapolis 500-mile race, one of the true sportsmen and great ambassadors for the sports to this day, to the sport for this day. But he and Donald Davidson talked about that controversial finish, and we'll hear from both when we return to Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and can't find what you need, Quality Supply and Tool has served Hoosiers for over a quarter of a century. Tom Hawk is the branch manager of the Indy location on South Harding Street.
We've always been big on keeping our shelves fully stocked of inventory of industrial-grade tools, concrete, masonry products, as well as the necessary accessories to help get the job done. You don't have it, you can't sell it. Our experience allows us to help with getting the pros as well as the weekend pro taken care of.
Quality Supply and Tool also has locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to help you think outside the box. Store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there. But you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at Kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Jake Query, Mike Thompson, inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, taking a look back at the 1995 Indianapolis 500 mile race. A tale of two Canadians. One of them, as you just heard, went to victory lane in the form of Jacques Villeneuve. The other had to drive past it. Scott Goodyear with, quite frankly, just an empty feeling in that 1995 race. Scott Goodyear talked about 1995 and passing by victory lane.
Yeah, I came down and, you know, first on the track, came into pit lane, and then they didn't signal me to actually go into victory lane. And, you know, so, I mean, it's another confirmation of what just happened at the flag station when they didn't give you the checkered flag. And then, you know, it was very quiet in the radio all the way around. And, you know, I felt bad for not winning the race, but I felt bad for the team. The sponsors that are involved in there, Honda and Firestone, and, you know, my wife was in tears. And, you know, but as a driver, you know, at that point in time, you just give yourself more confidence, you know, because it's now, I've been to Indy a few times, and, you know that you're capable of winning the race because you know that you're fast enough and being able to drive these things at over 230 miles an hour. So you feel that you're going to come back and do it again. So to me, it was probably not as harsh on me as I think the rest of the people that were living it that weren't sitting in the seat.
Mike, you spoke with Scott in 2015, and he made it pretty clear still that he did not agree with the penalty, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, as you said, he's a great ambassador of the sport. I mean, a great person, one of my favorite people, always willing to give his time for these kind of projects and things like that. But I will say, as much as I like Scott as a person, I just don't agree with his take on this race. I mean, I think, you know, it's one of those situations he made a mistake, and it happens in the course of the race. You make a mistake, and it's just one of those things that, you know, he passed the pace car, and that's just one of those deals. But, you know, he was very generous with his time and talk about why he didn't agree with the penalty.
It's very difficult to sit there and you can look at it, you know, five different ways if you want to. But the key thing is that when the pace car is having some issues, it's not really consistent all day. You know, maybe I should have put it in neutral coming out of turn two and let him leave until I couldn't see him any further. But, you know, I gave him a big space in that day and, you know, let him get out of sight, and then finally got in the gas going into turn three. And I was shocked as anybody else that he was still sitting there. But, you know, it's supposed to be going a certain speed and then supposed to turn its lights off and get going to 100 miles an hour. And, you know, I keep hearing reports it was only doing 80 or whatever the scenario was. The end result was, you know, we got penalized. We got disqualified for something I don't think was correct.
By refusing the penalty, Goodyear would fall all the way to 14th in the final standing. So, as of course, once the black flag came out and Paul Page had mentioned it on television, you could start to see on the computer monitoring and timing and scoring him dropping down throughout all of it. Scott Goodyear's thoughts on not serving that black flag penalty.
You know, when he said that, and Steve was very calm in the radio, and I was very calm back to him, he just said, hey, they're going to disqualify you, say, for passing the pace car. You need to do a drive-through. And, you know, it was probably a half a lap later, I pushed the button very calmly and just said, Steve, that's not going to happen. And there's no way for us to go back and win on that. And he just pushed the button. He goes, okay. See you after the race. And we just continued on and, you know, had how many second lead it was at the end of the event. And, you know, because back in karting days, I first lived that, you know, where you get a black flag and you didn't do anything wrong. You know, somebody's, you know, thinks they saw something in the back of the course. And I did that. I mean, I came in early in my career and then you never got put back to where you should when it wasn't you that made the infraction. So I learned very early on in my career in karting that you just stay out there, you continue to run, and then you come in and fight for it. Matter of fact, the chief steward at that time, Tom Binford, came to me the evening of the award ceremony in downtown Indianapolis after it was over and we're walking out, and he walked up to me and said, extended his hand to shake my hand and said, I wished you had to come in and serve the penalty. And I looked at him and I said, what benefit of that? And he said, well, you would have finished probably 6th or 7th instead of, I think we finished 14th. Clearly not a racer. I mean, because you know what, that's not what I'm there for, you know. And you know, when you've been so close and you've finished second and you're capable of winning this race, I didn't come here to be second or fifth or 12th or anything of that nature. So I just politely excused myself before I said something that I probably would have regretted, and I just walked away because it was clearly in my mind not the right call.
One of the persistent myths about that 1995 Indianapolis 500, and Bobby Unser's commentary on the broadcast had a lot to do with this, was that the pace car was simply going too slow on the last restart. But you know about the old television show Mythbusters. Donald Davidson played Mythbuster, if you will, and pops the balloon on that theory about the pace car being the culprit in the controversy.
And some people were saying, oh, the pace car was going slower than it had all day. Actually, it was going faster than it had all day, except the optical illusion is that Scott's doing 200 miles an hour, and he went, you know, just blowing by it. But so then Scott is out there and the conversations are going on, and he's probably aware of the conversations, and you got to keep going. And then the black flag comes out. Well, what are you supposed to do? I mean, they may change their mind later, but if you came in, you gave it up. So I think they did the only thing that they could do. But what a heartbreaker, because he clearly had it won.
So what we've learned over the course of the last hour or so, and thank you for listening as always to Beyond the Bricks. I can't tell you what a thrill it is for Mike and I, not just to do this, but also to have people reach out on how much they enjoy taking a look back on what is the greatest sporting event in the world. And that 1995 race, the reality is, Mike, there was just a ton to unpack. And it was one of those races. Sometimes you have races where it's pretty obvious from the beginning who the dominant car is and who's going to win the race. Juan Montoya's rookie year comes to mind. But in terms of the second year of Jacques Villeneuve, that was one of those that seemingly the storyline changed about 20 different times.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. I mean, like I say, there were so many different people who had a chance to win. I mean, we didn't really talk again that much about Gujo. I mean, he led the most laps. I mean, Jacques Villeneuve only led 15 laps. So it was not a day where he dominated. And a lot of that is because he got the early penalty and was fighting his way back after the penalty. But you're right. A number of different people had chances to win, and twists and turns with Michael going out when he was leading, and Vasser and Pruitt in the mix, and just an interesting day. But you know, I really appreciate that Scott Goodyear gives us the time to talk about something that's got to be so devastating to still talk about years later. You know, it's got to be so, you're so close to your dream. And I felt the same way when J.R. Hildebrand did that for us. You know, he talked about, you know, being so close to that dream and just a corner away. And you know, I mean, he could say, no, I'm not talking about that, but no, he gave really insightful answers, and so did Scott, about, you know, that disappointment and how he, you know, how it felt to not get that victory that you was so close to getting. But you know, one of the things I think was really important is what Donald said is, you know, there's this myth constantly that, oh, the pace car was going so slow. And I think part of that is, again, because Bobby, you know, Unser said, oh, the pace car is too slow. He said it just like that on the broadcast. But, you know, that isn't the case. So it's important to have shows like what we're doing tonight to talk about this and to unpack it all, because there is a lot to unpack in 1995.
Scott Goodyear would, of course, go on to a runner-up finish in 1997 in the Indianapolis 500-mile race and would complete 11 over the course of his career. Jacques Villeneuve would come back one more time in Indianapolis, but not until 2014. He started that race 27th, completed all 200 laps, finished in 14th. We're finished for tonight. For Landon Kunz, Mike Thompson, I'm Jake Query. Thanks so much for listening to Beyond the Bricks.
The future of Harlem rests in your hands.
The MGM Plus original series, Godfather of Harlem, returns. Starring Academy Award winner Forrest Whitaker.
There's a new kid in town.
And Rome Flynn as Frank Lucas.
I'm the boss of me.
Critics rave about the rare gangster epic.
My father's planning a war.
Praising it as a great prestige drama.
Nobody plays Frank Lucas. We will go to war.
Godfather of Harlem. Watch now only on MGM Plus.
My breakfast needs two things: eggs and to be easy on my wallet. But these days, that's hard to find. Luckily, I know where to look. McDonald's. And now as part of the buy one, add one for $1 breakfast deal, I get the breakfast I want at the price I love. From the Egg McMuffin to a sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, or even the sausage McMuffin with egg. My wallet and my taste buds stay happy. But hurry, these sandwiches and this deal won't last. Bag up your next breakfast at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Prices and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Valid for item of equal or lesser value.